Think advertising on TikTok isn't for your business? Think again.
With TikTok ads, we went from 250,000 downloads to over 1 million downloads in less than a year.
I'm Eve.
I'm Anam, and we're the co-founders of Alinea.
Alinea Invest is an investing app for Gen Z.
We run 50 new ads per week with 3 variations thanks to TikTok's Smart Plus campaigns. If you're not advertising on TikTok, you're missing out.
Drive more app downloads only on TikTok. Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hello and welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today we have Dr. Kenneth J. Doka. He is the author of When We Die. It is a book on how we address death, how we approach death in different ways. It's really a fantastic book. I will have the links to the book at the bottom of this podcast. Kenneth has edited or written over 33 acclaimed academic books on death-related subjects, and is also a senior consultant for the Hospice Foundation. Before I get into my conversation with Dr. Doka, I would like to give a couple shout-outs. My first shout-out is to Miranda Young and Chris Sumner. Miranda is the host of Ghost Bikers Explorations, fantastic show every week on Facebook Live. Plus, she is a paranormal investigator, as well as Dr. Chris Sumner, who also runs Soul Sisters Paranormal. They have joined forces a new business venture called History, Highways, and Haunts. Their base operation will be in the historic Scott County Jail. And as soon as they're taking reservations for tours of the facility, I will post that as soon as it is available. Congratulations to Miranda Young and Dr. Chris Sumner with their new adventure, History, Highways, and Haunts. Here is a short promo for Homespun Haints. They will be on in 2 weeks as my next guest. And you don't want to miss that one. They are fantastic. We'll be right back with my conversation with Dr. Kenneth J. Doka.
Ghost stories are always scarier when they're told by the very people who experience them. Hi, I'm Becky.
And I'm Diana.
And we're the hosts of the Homespun Haints podcast.
We talk to people just like you who've come face to face with ghosts, demons, haints, and other strange paranormal phenomena. All of it makes for a chilling good time.
To know that I've got a backyard full of thousands and thousands of dead people, and if I'm not in my body, who is in my body? And can I have it back, please?
So grab yourself a sweet tea, turn off the lights, and listen to some eerie, true ghost stories on Homespun Haints.
I'm not scared. Are you?
Today we have Dr. Kenneth J. Doka on the show. And welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast, Ken.
Thank you, Al. I'm delighted to be here.
And I see that you specialize in death, dying, and the afterlife.
Well, death and dying primarily, the study of thanatology. This became sort of a side interest of me, as I describe in the book, When We Die.
Right. And I myself being in the paranormal and dealing with so many different religions out there, usually in some of these cases, you know, with these churches on dying, some religions like the Catholic religion believe strongly in the purgatory. Mm-hmm. Where would you relate to purgatory in your studies?
Well, to tell the honest truth, I'm also a Lutheran clergyman, as well as having a PhD in clinical sociology. So purgatory has never been really one of my basic concerns. And one of the things I think that was fascinating as I began to explore this area was, a lot of these events that we describe in the book don't really fall easily into my spiritual views, my theology, nor in my scientific orientation as a sociologist. But over the years, I've worked 50 years now with dying and bereaved people. It's been fascinating to hear stories of people and of course, like you, to have my own experiences in this. That's been so fascinating.
Yeah, Ken, I've seen that like in the Lutheran church and like I said, a Methodist, they don't really believe in purgatory. That's like when you die, I mean, if you're a Christian, you're going to go to heaven.
That's the basic belief, yes. Mm-hmm.
So myself being a Catholic and my sister being a Methodist pastor.
An interesting experience, huh?
So I asked my sister, what do I call myself? Am I a Catholic or am I a Methodist? She said, well, if you're a Christian, that's all that matters. Mm-hmm. There are different ways of looking at things and different religions, you know. Because mm-hmm. I've had some guests on in the past that you talk about spirits and seeing spirits or being involved with the spirit. Some of them believe it's part of purgatory and others definitely do not. And I was reading your book, When We Die, Extraordinary Experiences at Life's End. Man, that was really well written.
Thank you. It was actually probably the book I had the most fun. I've written a lot of different books, mostly for academic audiences, but some, like Grief is a Journey, for the general audience. But this probably was the book I had the most fun writing, just because it brought me into all kinds of fascinating areas and helped me make sense of some of my own experiences as well.
And I've seen you've written over 35 books or edited them. I mean, that's quite of an accomplishment.
Well, as my son says, I have no life.
You've had an article appear in O, the Oprah magazine.
Yeah, that was some of my work on disenfranchised grief, and that refers to losses that people often experience, but often are not supported by others, so they really are not perceived as having a kind of right to grieve these losses.
Yeah, and you've also been on CNN and other national radio programs. Mm-hmm. If you were to make a business card, like where would you begin? You would need five of them.
I actually have three different business cards, really. One just a personal card, and one with mental health counselor, and one from the Hospice Foundation of America. So I have to carry all of them and use them when appropriate.
And I see you also have a blog called Good Morning for Psychology Today.
The blog called Good Morning, meaning, spelled MOURNING, really is a blog that tries to give advice to people. So, for instance, some of the topics on it might be things like, how to get through the holidays when you've experienced a loss, or what are some effective ways to cope with the death of a parent or a child? What are some of the issues you're going to experience? There's a whole range of articles on that. And that was a real honor and a real pleasure to be asked by Psychology Today to do that.
You know, the one that really struck me was that really caught my attention was a senior consultant and speaker for Hospice Foundation of America.
Yeah.
And that one, that got me because hospice is so fantastic. I mean, I can't even put into words. I mean, they were there for my mother before she passed when she was in a hospice house. And also my mother-in-law, my mother mm-hmm. died of a very rare Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease.
Yeah, one of those orphan diseases that we unfortunately don't spend as much time researching as we should.
You know, when you're talking about, preparing for death, I just was just totally drawn in with the hospice.
Yeah, the Hospice Foundation of America does an incredible job. And what they primarily do for hospices is to offer resources and education on grief. So it's been a labor of love to be their consultant. I've really enjoyed it.
Before you got into your profession, grieving and death, what led you to that?
Okay, yeah, it's an interesting story. When I was actually in graduate school, my area of interest was delinquency and criminology, but mostly delinquency. I had to do an internship, and I had the perfect place for it. I was going to do an internship at the Spofford Center, and the Spofford Center in New York is where the authorities hold delinquents who, for one reason or another, either because of chaotic families or because of the nature of the crime, or often because of both, they can't release the delinquents to their families, so they're institutionalized prior to, it's like a jail for adolescents, for lack of a better word. So I was, you know, that was for me, for my interest in delinquency, the perfect place to be. And then about a week before I was to go out there and begin, I was studying in St. Louis. I got a letter from my supervisor saying, guess what? I shifted jobs. I'm now at Sloan Kettering, which is a major research hospital in New York for cancer, a major cancer center. And he said, you can, you know, if that's not what you want to do, you can be released from your obligation, or you can join me at Sloan Kettering as a you know, intern. And I really had no interest in doing that, none at all. But I also had no option because I was planning on taking an internship during the summer. And, you know, in 2 weeks with finals and stuff like that, I never would have found anything. So I kind of thought, well, I'm just going to grin and bear it and, you know, do my best. And then I was, when I was driving back to New York where I lived, I thought, well, this isn't so bad. You know, I've had a lot of work working with children and adolescents. This will round out that experience, giving me an opportunity to work with adults. Of course, as soon as I got out there, he said, the first thing he said to me was, you're just the person we need in the adolescent and pediatric ward. So I found myself working with dying children. That was in 1971. And what I realized as I went through that summer is, you know, one of the ways that I work with loss and grief was to read about it and to try to study about it and, you know, to get as much information as I can. And in those days, remember, it was just in the very beginning of the movement, you could probably do that in a good afternoon. Mm-hmm. So I decided I had to do a thesis for the seminary and I had to do a thesis for my sociology degree. And I thought, well, I'll do it on the issues of dying children. And I did. And they were both published. And I sort of found myself on the ground floor, what I would call the second generation of people who were studying death and dying. And so, I, you know, as I said, it was never my expectation to be in this area. But, you know, what do they say? God laughs at our plans and puts us in the areas that he thinks we should be. So that's how I got in the field.
Yeah, I never believe that, you know, things happen by coincidence. I think they happen for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, you're talking about the death of a child.
Yeah, we don't expect children to predecease us, at least not in contemporary Western societies. Unfortunately, that's not the case all over.
And starting out with your book, you know, the death of that 3-year-old little girl, and it kind of struck me, you know, because I wasn't thinking about the mother, you know, of being questioned by the police, you know, because, you know, if you die of just natural causes at 3 years old, I mean, and you're also put under the spotlight.
She died of sudden infant death syndrome. It's late for that to happen, but it still can, you know, happen up to 4. And of course, you know, in any of those cases, SIDS cases, there's always a little bit of an investigation.
Seen in there that you dealt with a lot of children's dying and death.
Yeah, and that was a fascinating story, I thought, you know, and as I said, I was just a young counselor when that mother came to me. And if you remember the story, when she buried her daughter, one of the special mother-daughter minutes or moments that they would have is that when she was going out or doing something special, she'd put on her good perfume and she'd put on a little bit on her daughter. Her daughter would insist that she, you know, put perfume on her. And then she'd go out and make sure everybody smelled how nice she smelled, just like mommy. And then when she died, when the daughter died, she anointed the daughter, really, as they closed the casket and put the perfume in the basket. And then months later, and switched to a new brand, if you remember the story, mm-hmm. months later, she came into the room and smelt the smell of that perfume all over. So it was incredible. And she, as she's telling me this, I didn't have any clue as to how to respond. It was the first time I'd ever heard of this kind of experience. I wondered if she was hallucinating. Happily, I think I said the right thing. Just out of shock, I said, "What did that mean to you?" And she said, "It was my daughter telling me she was okay." And I thought, that's a fascinating experience. I've had lots of these experiences that I just sort of filed away as kind of interesting, but, you know, what do they mean? When I did this book, it gave me an opportunity to revisit those and to look at the research around those kinds of experiences. And to me, it was just a fascinating experience. As I said, I think of all the books I've written, this is the one I enjoyed writing the most. Some research has shown about 60% of people who have suffered a loss have these kinds of losses, have these kinds of experiences, where they have a sense experience of the person, or a sense of the person, or some kind of symbolic incident, or dreams, or, you know, or other kinds of extraordinary experiences.
So being in the a minister, Lutheran,
yeah,
what is your beliefs on, like, moving on? Like, say some people don't move on, so the spirit's still here, or they did move on and the spirit's here.
Yeah, I guess I'm a non-judgmental person. I don't have to systematize everybody. I just kind of file these as sort of interesting, mm-hmm. you know, and try to say, I wonder what this means. So, you know, I think it has convinced me that something is going on because these experiences are so common. And I've had one myself, but I think it's hard to, I haven't really been able to codify it into my system of beliefs, and I don't really need to. I just can hold them aside and say, interesting.
I was just curious because, you know, being a psychologist, you know, and dealing with death. I had a past guest on, ran a paranormal investigation team, and his whole team were atheist or agnostic. So naturally, he didn't believe in moving anything on because what are you moving on to? That was his answer. Yeah. So if you don't believe in heaven or hell, you're not moving the spirit on anywhere. You're just killing the spirit. Yeah. And that really floored me because I've always believed in heaven and hell. I always believed that you're either going up or down, you know? Yeah. And so I was kind of floored by that. I was just curious because, you know, being a prime minister yourself.
I think that if anything, my work 50 years in the field has made me both more sure that there's something after and less, maybe a little less sure as to what exactly it is, you know, kind of a paradox. But I do remember, and I tell the story in the book of one of my clients who was dying and had a dream. And she believed that when you died, you died. That was it. She was very, you know, that was it. That was the end. You know, as she said once, the book slams and it's all written. The story's done. Exactly how she put it. And then she dreamed that she was in this lovely garden. Right before she died, she expressed this dream that she was in this lovely garden and she was walking around and she saw this gardener. And this gardener showed her all the stuff and all the flowers. And she said they were beautiful. And she was interesting because she was a real, you know, really into gardening. She said there were flowers that shouldn't belong together. You know, they're from different places, from different seasons, but they all bloomed beautifully together in this garden. You know, some were tropical, some were temperate. And she said the gardener came up to me and introduced himself and said, you'll be helping me. Very shortly. And when she woke up, she said, you know, maybe there is more.
It kind of leads me into, like, you know, a psychic or a medium. I mean, have you ever had any cases where kind of floored you and just set you back?
Oh, I think lots of these cases have done that where, you know, you think, as I said, they just challenge your beliefs. And, I had an interesting experience. I was in Kansas City for a wedding. Of a colleague, had nothing to do that morning. I really only knew the couple who were getting married. I didn't know any of their friends or anything like that. And so I was just wandering in Kansas City and I came on this New Age thing and there was a medium in there. So I thought, I got some time to kill. Well, let me see what happens. So I walked in and she had some time and we set up a session and all of a sudden she said to me, you don't have to feel guilty. She said, Michael is very pleased with what you've done. And at first I thought my son, his name is Michael, but then she said, no, it's not your son. It's someone you helped. And years ago, when I first started getting involved in the field of delinquency, I was working with a young child, sort of like a big brother kind of program, with a younger child by the name of Michael. And he reappeared in my adulthood and asked me to be the godfather of his son. And, you know, and I agreed. I thought that was lovely and very nice. And I agreed. And unfortunately, he had been an IV drug user. This was in the 1970s and early 80s. And then when his son was born, his wife threw him out of the house. And he went into rehab, and this time it held, because she wouldn't let him back in the house. She said, I've lived with your addiction for all of our married life, but our son is not going to spend one day with it. And so he came back, he reconciled with her, and then unfortunately found out he was HIV infected. Remember, this was in the early days when the normal lifespan was about 3 years. I always felt, you know, maybe I could have done more for him when he was younger. You know, I was away at college much of that time. You know, I'd connect with him by phone on occasion. I'd certainly connect with him when I was home at summer vacation. But, you know, but I really thought about that. And it was a kind of phenomenal experience to hear her come up with those names. And you know, when she had the son's name right as well. And she said, you know, he's very happy that you're involved in Keith's life, you know, and it just seemed like a blow out of nowhere. I thought, you know, okay, you know, there's got to be something going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, reading your book, I mean, so many different stories in there and different ways of dealing with death and trying to cope with it. With the 9/11, the one part you had on the police officer on his day off, you know, not being able to say that last goodbye.
Yeah.
Same with the COVID this past year, you know, COVID-19. So many people died that didn't get to be with their loved ones at their time of death.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that last goodbye or I love you or anything like that.
Which can be so important for people.
I think, you know, you need some form of closure.
In our field, we always say bring closure to the term closure. But certainly a good step in the journey of grief is the ability to have an opportunity to say what you need to say before the person dies, or if not, to find a way to say it after.
Right. And you also had in your book about premonitions, you know, I love the part where I did some research on Mark Twain a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I did read that where when he was born under the Halley's Comet and when he died, that Halley's Comet was all entering the Earth's orbit.
Yeah. And he predicted that. He said he came in with an extraordinary event and he'd go out with one.
What about curses?
Didn't really consider that in the book, but I'm always sensitive to people. Well, one of the things we do talk about is that, you know, if someone thinks that they're under a curse or something, it's really important not to just dismiss it, but to deal with it. I told of an incident in the book where when we were talking about premonitions, that in some parts of New York, some papers will deliver part of the Sunday paper on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not the news section, but, you know, the leisure section, the stuff that, you know, that's printed ahead of time.
Yeah,
the ads, the comics, right. You know, all those kinds of stuff. And this one old Italian guy found a crow. A crow had come in and hit his stoop wall and was lying dead on Sunday's newspaper. And crows in his culture were an omen of death. And so he thought he was cursed on that. And we actually, the son called me up sort of frantic. The son was a former client of mine, said, what do I do? My father's convinced he's going to die. You know, and we talked about helping him through that omen. And he did not die. But, you know, I believe if you strongly believe you're going to die a certain way or a certain day, sometimes your body responds to that stress. We created a situation where he got some counseling and he did survive. But until his father's dying day, which was many years later, on that particular day, he and his sister would always come and visit the dad or make sure the dad was involved, just in case he thought, well, you know, it may not be this 3rd of June, but, you know, it could be the 3rd of June 22, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there was another incident where I was dealing with a Haitian American woman who was having minor surgery. And as I always like to quote physicians who say there is no such thing as minor surgery. Every surgery, you know, has problems or has issues. We actually brought in a priestess who removed the curse because the physician was convinced that if this woman went to surgery with the strong belief that she would die during it, she would in fact die during it. And so we did this ritual where the woman came in and the priestess came in, not only removed, you know, did a ritual to remove the curse, but also blessed the surgeon's hands. And that was very comforting to this woman who had a very uneventful surgery after that.
You also have in there the NDE, the near-death experience.
Yeah.
But I thought that was, the near-death experiences and your stories under that were very fascinating.
Thank you.
So you have a lot in this book, and I think it's a must-read for all my listeners out there to pick this book up.
Well, thank you. I really, as I said, it was probably the book I had most fun and most enjoyment and learned a lot in the writing of it.
So you also have in there reincarnation.
I started out with an interesting case there. I thought of somebody who came to me and he had these recurrent Well, he had an experience that he hadn't been able to make sense of. And in that experience, he described it as almost a flashback when he was now in his 30s. But it was when he remembered this happened clearly when he was like 8 years old in third grade. And he's bored and sitting in the auditorium. And all of a sudden, he sort of has, and the only way he could describe it as a flashback, a flashback of a knockback was how he called it. You know, in other words, this obviously didn't happen to him, but it came with the clarity of a flashback, in which he saw himself homesick and seasick on a British schooner, like a warship, had no knowledge that, you know, that often the second sons of the British elite were often sent to sea at very young ages, much like you see in the movie Master and Commander, if you remember that, to be training to be young officers. And so he just remembers talking to the captain saying, well, this is your life now and you'll have to get used to it. Nothing. He said it was nothing dramatic. I didn't, you know, all of a sudden whip in and save the ship or, you know, or do anything. It was just this moment. He said it just seemed so clear to me when I was 8 years old and watching this. And he said, I didn't have any reference to it at all. I didn't know that British families sent their second sons, their later sons into the Navy for careers. He said, I knew none of that, but it all happened.
He also had a part in there about Ghost Month, you know, like in different cultures, like, you know, where some of these cultures, how we deal with death, you know. And I thought that was fascinating how, and I didn't know that, you know, you celebrate the dead by having a picnic at the gravesite.
Yeah. Well, they do that in Mexico in the Day of the Dead.
The other countries, you know, have, you know, celebrated the death, but, you know, different ways.
Yeah. You know, there's a theory in a very prevalent theory in the field of thanatology, which is the study of death, which says we oscillate or move between two different healthy grieving means that you move between two sort of different poles, you know, and move back and forth between those. And oscillate is the term that they use, Strobe and Schutt. And one of those is of course, you know, you have to mourn the death. And one of those, the other one of those is that you have to learn to live life now in the face of that death. And so, you know, I always illustrated to a class by saying, I once had a client who came to me and said very proudly, for the first time since my husband died, I was able to balance my checkbook. And then the next week when she came in, she said, after I left you, I kind of plunged a little bit in my grief because I thought if John were alive, I wouldn't have to worry about that. You know, that going back and forth between. And I think the same thing happens in good funerals, that there has to be a piece of celebrating. This is someone we loved and this is someone who made their mark. However that mark was made, maybe just in the lives of the people around him or her. And then at the same point in time, we have to acknowledge the mourning. One of the things that sort of scares me about contemporary funerals is that, you know, we need to do both. And I think sometimes we're so focused on the celebration of life that we don't acknowledge that, no, while we do want to celebrate that life, we also have to acknowledge the loss and we also have to acknowledge the grief.
So I want to thank you, Doctor, for being on my show. And it's been really my privilege to have you on.
Well, I'm sorry. I've been honored to be on it. I really want to thank you so much for inviting me.
And where can my followers get a hold of you or pick up your books?
Well, When We Die is available through Barnes & Noble, through Amazon, through all the common sites. Llewellyn is the publisher. You can also see my work and see some of the things that I'm doing. My website is Dr. Ken Doka, just, you know, www.drkendoka.com, and love to be in contact. Nice talking to you, Al.
Thank you, Dr. Doka. I really enjoyed this interview. I had mentioned at the very beginning of this episode that Dr. Doka had over 33 books out. Dr. Doka has over 35 books out. And I do encourage you to go to his links at the bottom of this podcast and check out Dr. Kenneth J. Doka's works. I'm your host, Al Cooley, Ghosts in the Valley Podcast.